Welcome once again to our program, The Da Vinci Code Deciphered. We're talking about the book, The Da Vinci Code, the movie, and now the DVD that has come out. That was so much against the fundamentals of the Catholic faith, even the Christian faith, that Jesus is not really God, he was just a man, that Mary Magdalene was supposed to be the first of the apostles, and that Peter took over her place and knocked her out of her rightful place, and that the church, the Catholic Church, for 2,000 years has really tried to keep hidden the idea of the sacred feminine that Jesus was really trying to bring forth when he was here. So we've talked quite a bit, and this brings us about the Da Vinci Code and the people and the background of it, and Dan Brown's sources. We've been talking a lot, and my guest again is, of course, Ron Eldred, who teaches church history, American history, government, and religion at John Paul II Catholic High. And I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus, St. Patrick Catholic Church here at 19th and Poplar. Ron, welcome once again. We've talked a lot about, in the series, Elaine Pagels. She's come up so much in the discussion, and you mentioned she was recently on television, just last night, I believe, on the National Geographic program. So she's quite well known, and she's one of the authors that Dan Brown lists as one of his primary sources. So what can you tell us about Elaine Pagels and these famous, or infamous, the early church fathers would say, Gnostic Gospels?
Well, the program I saw last night was a two-hour program put on the National Geographic Channel on the Gospel of Judas, which we'll have occasion to maybe discuss a little bit later on.
But Judas the Apostle.
Judas, okay. The Apostle. And then also I've seen her on at least three or four programs on the Da Vinci Code on various channels, and I've seen her on programs on the Gnostic Gospels. So she's considered one of the, if not the main source, although there's other people like Marvin Meyer and a few others. But nonetheless, she is the most scholarly, I think, of all Dan Brown's sources. And you know, in his book, he quotes, he has a bibliography where he includes several books that he claims that are, you know, very scholarly and well-researched and, historically true and all that kind of thing. But she is truly the most scholarly, I think, of some of the ones he relies upon for his sources are not very scholarly at all.
Okay.
But nonetheless, Elaine Pagels, I'll tell a little bit about her. She took her doctorate at Harvard University. While at Harvard, she was part of a team that studied the Nag Hammadi library codices, or books, which had been discovered in Egypt in 1945. They're long-lost Gnostic writings, and I think there was a little over 50 of them, something like that. The only thing we knew about these Gospels, and they weren't all Gospels, some of them were like epistles, other types of Gnostic writings. The only thing we knew about them was long quotations written by some of the church fathers who quoted them out so they could refute them. People like St. Irenaeus comes to mind.
Early 2nd century.
Yes, in the 180s. She taught and headed the Department of Religion at Bernard College before joining the faculty at Princeton University, where she is today a professor of early Christian history. And her study of the Nag Hammadi codices was the basis for her book, The Gnostic Gospels, which was published in 1979. And the book is a popular introduction to the Nag Hammadi library, where she describes, you know, what's in these Gnostic writings. It became a bestseller and won both the National Book Critics Award, Circle Award, the National Book Critics Circle Award, and the National Book Award, and was chosen by the Modern Library as one of the 100 best books of the 20th century.
That's pretty good recognition.
Yes, it is. The National Book Award, in fact, is one of the highest awards a scholar can receive for a book. So it would seem that she has impeccable academic credentials. And she is very impressive to listen to and to watch. But she's very likable, you know, and she's intelligent, and she's very knowledgeable, you know, extremely knowledgeable person. In fact, talking about the National Book Award, one of my own professors, advisors of history, when I was in graduate school at the University of Illinois, Dr. Raymond Phineas Stearns, he won this National Book Award for one of his many books. And he was one of the most prestigious professors, you know, in the country, in fact, in the world, in history. So obviously, she is in very, very high,
circles.
Yes.
All right. We've talked so much about the Gnostic Gospels. Are these early Gospels, which we would call fraudulent or fake Gospels, the Church never accepted. What are the main ideas that Elaine Pagel states in the Gnostic Gospels?
Well, Pagel's claims in the book that the early Christian Church was founded in a society that represented a number of contradictory viewpoints. She claims that the early Church had many groups, each possessing different ideas about Jesus and his teachings. You could really see this in the two-hour program that I watched last night. She believes that Gnosticism was not a very coherent movement, and that the different Gnostic groups disagreed over several points, which is true, I think. She says that Gnosticism attracted women in particular because of its egalitarian perspective, which allowed their participation in sacred rites. In the Gnostic Gospels and in another book entitled Adam, Eve, and the Serpent, she studied the way that women have been viewed in Christian history, and as a consequence, her ideas have become important in the feminist study of religion. In fact, she has become a quote, darling of a feminist history among radical feminists.
A real champion.
Oh, yes, a real champion.
Okay.
A little bit about her own personal life, I think, which might partially explain. After losing a young son to illness and her husband in a hiking accident in 1987 mm-hmm. and 1988, respectively, she claims she had a religious experience, which led her to research and write a book called The Origin of Satan.
Satan, the devil?
Yes.
Okay.
And this book purports to show how Satan became a way for Orthodox Christians to demonize their religious opponents and the Jews as well, demonize the Jews and the unorthodox Christians such as the Gnostics. Her major work, The Gnostic Paul, her next major work, The Gnostic Paul, that's the name of the book, The Gnostic Paul, okay, compares Gnosticism in the early Catholic Church. And this book expands the theory that St. Paul was a Gnostic, whose influence on the direction of the early church was great enough that Orthodox Christians forged Timothy and Titus, two of Paul's letters, to make it appear that Paul supported their interpretation rather than Gnosticism.
So the claim actually that the early church, early Catholic Church, actually invented, forged,
yes,
made up the letters of Timothy and Titus.
To offset Paul's other letters, which she believes were Gnostic in nature.
Okay.
I believe her last book is her New York Times bestseller, Beyond Belief. I actually have a copy of that. I haven't had a chance to read it yet. But Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas. And in it, Pagels contrasts the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of John, and argues that a close reading of these books demonstrates that John emphasizes that Jesus is the light of the world, whereas Thomas teaches individuals that there is a light within each person, and it lights up the whole universe. If it does not shine there is darkness, end of quote. Well, that's, you'll see later on, that's kind of Gnostic kind of way of saying things. Okay. Moreover, she says that Thomas also shares with other Gnostic secret teachings a belief that Jesus is not God, but rather a teacher who seeks to uncover the divine light in all human beings. That's something else that came out last night in the two-hour program. She argues that the Gospel of John was written as a reaction and rebuttal to the Gospel of Thomas. And she also claims that during the time of persecution of Christians, the church fathers invented the canon, the creed, and the hierarchy, and suppressed some of the spiritual resources, such as Gnosticism, to avoid a conflict with Roman law and religion. I think it's easy to see why Dan Brown relies so much on Elaine Pagel's interpretation of history, because you see a lot of these themes in his book, The Da Vinci Code.
Okay, so we're talking about the Gnostic Gospels as comparable to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the traditional Gospels that the Church has accepted from, say, the councils in the 4th century. That determine what books go in the Bible or not, and that the Gospel of Thomas and others you've mentioned already, Judas and so forth, were rejected. They didn't really belong in there. And so what we're trying to do is, Gnostic means hidden, something beyond what ordinary people would know about. And information that only certain people can find out about.
Yeah, it means hidden knowledge, actually. Gnosis from the Greek means to know. And so basically it's the idea of hidden knowledge.
Okay.
Secret knowledge. Sometimes you'll see the word secret knowledge used.
All right. Okay, now from what you said, Elaine Pagel certainly has high academic credentials. Renowned reputation, how faultless or impeccable is her research and writing?
Some prominent historians have questioned her scholarship. For example, Father Paul Minkowski, a Jesuit priest and scholar at the Pontifical Biblical Institute in Rome. You know, that's one of the most prestigious scholarly biblical schools in the world. He writes, quote, Pagel's The Gnostic Gospels is in large measure a polemic against St. Irenaeus.
Polemic meaning an argument.
An argument, yes.
Okay, trying to destroy what St. Irenaeus is saying.
Yes.
Okay.
Bishop of Lyon and a father of the church. And is aimed in particular against the defense of ecclesial orthodoxy offered by Irenaeus in his work against heresies, his famous work that he wrote against the Marcion heresy, and the Arian heresy hadn't come up yet, so the Valentinian and some of those. After a careful comparison of Pagels and Irenaeus, Father Minkowski, he found many discrepancies between what she said Irenaeus said and what he actually said.
Now, this is a pretty strong statement that Father Minkowski, the Jesuit biblical scholar at the Pontifical Biblical Institute in Rome, is saying that, and if I'm understanding you, she's misquoting on several occasions what Irenaeus actually said.
He's not only saying that, but he's proving that she did that.
All right.
In this regard, he says, quote, put simply, Irenaeus did not write what Professor Pagels wished he would have written. So she made good the defect by silently changing the text. Creativity, when applied to one's sources, is not a compliment. She is a very naughty historian, end of quote. Then he goes on to say, quote, or she would be, were she judged by the conventional canons of scholarship. At the Postgraduate Institute where I teach, and at any university with which I am familiar, for a professor or a grad student intentionally to falsify a source is a career-ending offense. Among professional scholars, Witness tampering is no joke. Once the charge is proven, the miscreant is dismissed from the guild and not readmitted, and in the quote. Moreover, he asserts that, and I'll continue to quote him here, the Gnostic Gospels, like those portions of Pagel's later work with which I am familiar, is chock full of tendentious readings and instances where counter evidence is suppressed.
All right, give me a little better explanation. What's a tendentious readings? Questionable readings?
Yes, that would be close enough.
Okay.
The example of creativity here discussed may fairly be called a representative specimen of her methodology. In other words, she does it frequently.
Okay.
And was singled out not because it's the worst example of its kind, but because it's among the most unambiguous. No one who consults the source test could give Pagels a pass. And that means she forfeits the claim to reliability as a scholar. Attractive as her ideological sympathies may be to many persons, including many academics, she does not deserve to be ranked with serious textual scholars like Claremont's James Robinson. I might add, James Robinson was the editor of the Nag Hammadi library.
Really? Oh, my.
And her testimony on the accuracy of inventions such as Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code cannot be solicited without irony. End of quote. So Father even brings up the Da Vinci Code here. And because, as I said earlier in this session, on the at least four programs I've watched about the Da Vinci Code on the Discovery Channel, the History Channel, and other channels, she is one of the guest scholars that's on these programs.
So as now, Ron, for 2,000 years, people have been trying to say that Jesus is not truly God, or he's not truly man, and the church has defended for 20 centuries that he is the mystery of the Word made flesh, God incarnate. And it's nothing new for people to deny Jesus being truly God or deny him being truly man. Okay, could you directly say what the Da Vinci Code says about radical feminism?
Yes. To tie in the Da Vinci Code with what we've just related, we'll quote Carl Olson here a little bit. Quote, "This perfectly describes the intent of the Da Vinci Code, which uses a fictional vehicle to promote the same agenda that a number of feminist and postmodern scholars have been working on since the 1960s. Those fans of Brown's novel who think the author has somehow stumbled upon new and never seen information might be surprised to know how commonplace his views are within the realm of Gnostic and feminist studies." End of quote. And I would add another source of his to Pagel's, Margaret Starbird. She's, you know, similar to Pagels in that kind of...
Okay, a feminist scholar.
Yes, feminist scholar. And then Olson again quotes Jenkins as saying, quote, "Over the last century, the literature on hidden gospels, genuine and fraudulent, has been pervaded by conspiratorial speculations that suggest that some powerful body, usually the Roman Catholic Church, is cynically plotting either to conceal the true gospel or to plant bogus documents to deceive the faithful. Such ideas run through the many novels and fictional presentations on the theme in the Hollywood film Stigmata. The Vatican is shown desperately trying to suppress a Jesus gospel, which is unmistakably modeled on the Gospel of Thomas."
Okay, so it's been going on in perhaps the last century.
Yes.
This attempt to debunk Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and replace them with the true Gnostic Gospels, or the hidden wisdom Gospels. All right, what about Dan Brown's claim that the early church was a very egalitarian or equal society led by both female and male bishops and priests? This is a very hot topic today.
This argument has absolutely no basis in historical fact, and even Pagels admits as much. I've heard that she stated in the 1998 PBS program, From Jesus to Christ. Quote, I don't see a picture of a golden age of egalitarianism back there. I see a new, informed, diverse, and threatened movement which allowed a lot of much fluidity for women in certain roles for a while. In some places and not in others. Olson tells us that a feminist scholar speculating about the first few decades of the early church usually treat the New Testament documents with a lot of suspicion, claiming that they are the work of those men who finally gained control over the church through the suppression of women. And let me quote him here. Using a hermeneutics of suspicion, hermeneutics has to do with interpreting the scriptures.
Okay.
The hermeneutics of suspicion. He quotes Jenkins as saying, quote, these scholars must ignore early evidence that the church was founded by Christ and its leadership on earth given to 12 men. And then he goes on and quotes Matthew and Luke and John and places where that's
clearly stated about the 12 apostles stated. Being the foundations stones of Jesus' church or new beginnings.
Yes, and these 12 men led by Peter and must instead insist upon using texts that were written anywhere from 50 to 300 years after the New Testament documents, end of quote.
So the attempt goes on, as it does today, by many well-intentioned people, I would say, to say that Peter was not the head of the apostles, as is clearly stated in Matthew, in particularly Matthew and the other Gospels, and to say that Jesus really didn't set up a visible organization with Peter as the what we would say the first pope, and Benedict XVI being the 264th successor in an unbroken line back to St. Peter himself. All right, is it true that Gnostic writings are not exclusively pro-woman?
Well, that is true.
There's sometimes they're anti-woman.
Yes.
That's a tricky thing, not exclusively pro-woman.
Olson quotes Jenkins as saying, quote, there has been the misleading notion that the Gnostic writings are consistently pro-women. While the New Testament writings, and thereby the authors of those books, are anti-women. This idea also arises in the Da Vinci Code. After quoting from the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, where Peter complains about Mary's closeness to Christ, Sir Lee Teabing, you know, one of the characters in the book, states, I dare say Peter was something of a sexist. Teabing then remarks, Jesus was the original feminist. He intended for the future of his church to be in the hands of Mary Magdalene. As several of the Orthodox critics have noted, Brown never bothers to have his characters quote from the last verse of the Gospel of Thomas,
okay,
the most famous of the Gnostic texts, which states, Simon Peter said to them, let Mary leave us, for women are not worthy of life. Jesus says, I myself shall lead her in order to make her male, so that she too may become a living spirit, resembling you males. For every woman you will make herself male, who will make herself male, will enter the kingdom of heaven, end of quote. So that doesn't sound very pro-women there to me in a Gnostic gospel.
I think if that quote from the Gospel of Thomas could be spread around, people will begin to say why the church says that the Gospel of Thomas and those other supposedly hidden wisdom gospels are crazy.
That's a good point. That's a very good point. Well, as Olson says, quote, this passage and others like it do not fit well with the feminist view of the Gnostics. Just as the church's positive treatment of women throughout history does not compare well with the negative picture often depicted by feminist groups. This passage and others does not fit well with the feminist view of the Gnostics. Some popularized feminist works and the Da Vinci Code ignore this passage. Pagels, to her credit, addresses this by saying, quote, strange as it sounds, this simply states what religious rhetoric assumes. that the men form the legitimate body of the community, while women are allowed to participate only when they assimilate themselves to men, end of quote. Again, this is Pagels quoting that.
So at least she admits that that statement is in the Gospel of St. Thomas.
Yes. Unfortunately, many feminists believe that the way to equality with men is to adopt masculine traits and qualities. I mean, I could give a lot of examples of that, but and I'm sure you could too. But nonetheless, feminists routinely claim that Christianity is anti-woman and that the history of the church has been one of repressing and subordinating women. For example, Mary Daly, she's a Catholic, or claims to be a Catholic anyway. I think she might have been a nun at one time, I'm not sure.
Mm.
But she's a scholarly woman. Mary Daly asserts in Beyond God, the Father, toward a philosophy of women's liberation, that, quote, Christian theology widely asserted that women were inferior, weak, depraved, and vicious. The logical consequences of this opinion were worked out in a brutal act, or a brutal set of social arrangements that shortened and crushed the lives of women, end of quote. In its death, because it becomes a dynamic that drives beyond Christianity, or Christology, she claims that the women's movement does point to seek and constitute the primordial, almost present and future Antichrist. It does this by breaking the great silence, raising up a female pride, recovering female history, healing and bringing into the open female presence, end of quote. But as Olson states, Daly's broad claims of Christian cruelty toward women do not hold water. Indeed, they are based on a radical feminism that hates both men and Christianity with an intense, nearly demonic hatred. This is I'm quoting Olson there. I would recommend Donna Strychin's book, Ungodly Rage, to describe this hatred in detail. Olson concludes by saying Daly's teaching and writing has influenced a host of other feminist and feminist groups. And in addition to the works of Daly, many of these groups use Gnostic writings to buttress their arguments for female priests and other such types of things. He goes on to tell us that unfortunately such attempts to use ancient heretical movements for modern theological ends are common. They are also quite successful in part because many readers of works such as the Da Vinci Code, the Templar Revelation, or the Goddess and the Gospels know little if anything about ancient Gnosticism or about whether the Gnostic Gospels can rightfully be placed on the same level as the four Gospels of the Christian Bible.
I think the one quote we've had during this whole session this time that helps people understand why the church fought the Gnostic Gospels, and I want you to read it again from the Gospel of St. Thomas, what Simon Peter said, and supposedly Jesus' comment about that.
Jesus said, quote, I myself shall lead her in order to make her male, so that she too may become a living spirit resembling you males. For every woman who will make herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven.
Dramatic quote. May God bless all of you, always and in all ways.